be in the area, let me, maybe we can catch up.
Well, I appreciate that. It's one of those where I have to be quick in, quick out to get to the next city, so they've got my schedule pretty well wrapped.
Okay, let me know.
Okay.
If there's any gaps or any delays in flights, you're probably coming at the JFK, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, that's only, you know, 5-8 minutes from here, so keep me posted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How's life with you?
All right. Keeps you on your toes. It's good, you know, thank you.
Yeah.
It doesn't take too much to make me happy. You know, it's sunny here in New York, and, you know, it's a weekend day, so it's a looser schedule. And, yeah, you go out to get some exercise outdoors, enjoy a nice walk, maybe a little run. I haven't run in about 5 years. My knees have been acting up. I've been running since I was in high school. So I took off for like 5 years or so, and now I'm slowly seeing if I can tolerate it. So, you know, mixing in the walking with the, you know, a couple of blocks running here and there, it's enjoyable to do it again.
You're having some chilly temperatures there, aren't you?
Bring it on. I love it. It's free air conditioning. you know, I mean, I guess it gets to a point where you get frostbite. I don't want it to be that bad, but I like the cool air much better than the heat and humidity, for sure.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Somebody said to me once, there are a lot of things I can do to warm up, but not very many things I can do to cool down.
Yeah, I had the same theory. There's only a certain amount of clothing you can take off in the summer, but there's an endless amount you can put on in the winter.
Yeah. So, that's true.
Yeah.
Can I slip a halakhic question in?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I'm sure it has been, you know, endlessly discussed. I got a new book, I think it was Feldhahn that's put in there by a rabbi that covered all kinds of Jewish copyright law, and I was curious about that. But the question is the really simple one of, you buy a music CD, the physical CD, and you want to copy it onto your iPod. Does Halakha consider that to be an okay thing, or is any copying of an intellectual work considered
No, as a matter of fact, you can copy it for your friends, too. I had the same question years ago. I think I spoke to Rabbi Mann about it. And you're not doing it for commercial purposes. You own it now, and it's you own it completely. So it's I want to, you know, make some copies of it and give it to some friends. So I'm allowed to do that, too. So certainly you can copy it for your own use on multiple devices. Are you using a different phone today? It sounds a little muffled. It's hard to hear you.
Yeah, our big speaker phone is out in our living room, and our son is sleeping on the couch. So.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah,
yeah, it'll make it
sense.
Okay, so should we start? Are we ready to go?
I think so.
Was there any, you have a follow-up?
Yeah.
Any follow-up question to that, Halakha?
No, I noticed that I just started to read a part of this book, and his indications seem to be that the Torah does allow intellectual works, it does allow to be read on intellectual works, and so that his position was any copying of a cassette was a violation.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that interesting. The sources are there, but they're in Hebrew. And so I need to read more to get the full context. But that sounded very strict to me. And so I was just curious about whether it was all right to copy for one's own use.
Okay. Yeah, definitely permissible. The question, I guess, really is where does Halakha recognize these American law constructs, intellectual property, things of that nature? that I think would probably be the core issue.
Yeah.
I mean, how would we define intellectual property? I came up with an idea, or here they want to say that, you know, person has physical property, you know, so halacha, the Torah says that unless I relinquish my ownership, it's mine. So I have discrete cash, I have discrete, you know, numbers of coins or property. So those things aren't subject to duplication. So, I mean, the concept of duplication is an interesting thing. Because you can't even matter, you know, matter can either be created or destroyed. So if I have X amount of possessions, that's all I have. If I want to, you know, plant seeds and create new trees, it's not duplication. I mean, that's maybe the closest, you know, approximation we can get to that. Now suddenly we have this technology where you can take a document and you can, you know, or books, and you can copy them over. So if I have a book, so I own the physical property of the book. Now let's say somebody duplicates it. So it's not my book that he has right now, right? He used his own ink that he bought. He used his own paper. Now, is there any halachic issue about, let's say, the person making it as a business? He starts making duplication or painting, let's say. I make a beautiful painting and people love the painting, so I want to make copies of it so I can increase my business. So one thing which certainly he cannot do, he cannot encroach on my type of business. That's something which is called, you know, hasagas gavul, which means that you're encroaching on the boundaries of a person's property. So if I've got my area is roped off, I've got a yard that's, you know, 10 feet square, and now you move the boundary inwards, so now it makes my yard 9 feet square in order that you can increase yours. So that you can't do, but that applies also to going into a business of your friend. So clearly there'd be a problem. If I'm now making this exact painting and somebody starts copying it, so even though he's using his own materials, but now that's directly opposing a law. So that's one thing. The property itself, the physical, you know, ink or the paint or the canvas, that's his for sure. He owns it. The question of duplication is interesting, though.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, excuse me. I'm just wondering, in reference to copy, I don't know if I heard it right, in reference to copying a piece or a book, is there also the component of the fact that it's people who have made it or get paid to have somebody buy the book or buy the CD or whatever it might be? And if somebody is just copying it from their own, getting a blank disc and so on and so forth, or doing their printing, whatever, the person who produced it originally is getting less money because the person who is making it is not buying it from the store and paying the money.
Yeah, but we talked about that. We discussed that before, that is in, it's within a person's rights that once they own the CD or the album or whatever it is, they own it now, and they want to duplicate it for themselves or make some copies for their friends. They're allowed to do that because they're not doing it. You're allowed to do it. You're not doing it. They're not doing it for commercial reasons anyway. So giving a gift. So what were you pondering?
I would
listen
to Torah information that they would want people to copy and pass it along, so more people have what's going on the tape, having
radio
information, the learning that's possible.
Yeah, well, the Torah.
I don't understand that part of it. I, but maybe for commercial things like films and books and
Well, Tori, you have to keep in mind that Torah is not something which a person owns. It's not his to begin with.
Right, exactly. Okay. And it would be mitzvah.
That's an obligation. To, it's an obligation to the question. Well, that's separate. It's a separate issue.
Right.
Separate thing will come up, which I'm not there yet in terms of reproducing somebody else's books that they wrote. So that's not. Right now, we're just pondering the concept of duplication, and if that is something which is really, you know, within the realm of Torah, or is it just a American, you know, law? So that's what we're trying to understand right now. So the question we have, is there really duplication? And is there any prohibition to it? That's two things, really. So the first thing is, I don't see how there's real duplication outside of the area of, like, say, books or art. So, and for sure, that would be prohibited, because then you're encroaching. Because of the law, you're not allowed to encroach on somebody else's livelihood. You're minimizing his livelihood. Just give me 1 second. I just want to think about this. Give me 1 second. I really don't think I have enough information to answer it. I mean, you know, whether there's ownership on, like, Doug, you're talking about intellectual property. So if I have a certain design that has a very appealing quality, I could, you know, do I own that design? I mean, somebody else could make that same design. So the concept of copyright is really the question over here when it comes to, you know, things that are mundane, like a nice painting or a nice design or a logo for a company, things of that nature. Do I own the design, the conceptual design that the person can definitely duplicate? I got to think about it. I got to actually look up sources to see. All right. And if everybody could just put on your mute button until you speak. It's just getting some static over here. Yes, go ahead.
May I ask one last related question?
Sure, you can ask two questions.
I noticed when we got the copy of Philosophy of Torah.
Yeah.
But there is no copyright marking of any kind in the front of that book. Is that intentional?
Well, I mean, the purpose of, you know, producing that was to spread, you know, Rabbi Chait's ideas. And again, I mean, one thing strikes me is that I'm sure that his intent is that more people see the truth, and that's why he put things into writing to begin with. So that the issue never even crossed my mind. So it wasn't a matter of intent or not.
So I assume that quoting him, for example, I gave a class and I used some of the ideas in one of his articles with clear attribution and quoted him, and I think every time I quoted him, I said, this is a quote from Rabbi Chait. I assume there would be then no problem with that.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the right way to do it when you're teaching over Torah. So you're supposed to quote the person. And, you know, Torah is to be taught. So, you know, copywriting is antithetical to the whole concept of Torah.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Rabbi, can I just say something to you and to Doug? I'm just trying to say that, contrary, it's exactly what you're saying, Rabbi, that if you quote from a rabbi that said something, you should definitely say this is who. And so I said, I class, and things come up that the rabbi had heard when he attended the same rabbi's class, and things that he would commiserate with what did Rabbi Miller really say, this way or that way. I think this is a very positive thing. I think that they say burn copies, then it's really for the commercial reason that people don't want to lose out on money, but I don't think it's the same in the Torah world. I think that it's a positive thing to copy a tape and give it to somebody. Like you said, Rabbi, it's an obligation because they're spreading the good word. Do you think I'm right?
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. I have a friend who told me that she knows somebody who can make, would you like the movie again, or would you like the movie Finger on the Roof? My friend copies music and tapes. I can get you a copy. I don't think we're allowed to do that. That's what I think we're not allowed to do.
Yeah, you can. We already said that. You can copy that if you own it.
You can. And you said you can. Okay.
So you can copy it if you own it. That's right.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so let's start with Kehelas. We are up to today, chapter 5. Let me see, Avner had a question on the screen, one second. CD or DVD is meant for personal use. Wouldn't making copies depriving the original owner of the copyrights and then possibly making more money? Again, we answered that, Avner. All right, I hope that's clear now. Okay. You own it, and you're not using it, you're not duplicating it for commercial reasons. And we'll have to look further into what the concept is in the Torah, if there is a concept of copyright. And again, let me just ask Gary if they could just put the mute button on. There's a lot of static, at least I'm getting back here. So until you have, until we pause for questions and all, I'd appreciate that. Okay. So we're now, last week we started into the area of money, and this is actually going to be an ongoing theme for a couple of weeks, and we talked about this is chapter 5, verse 9. And we said that one who loves silver or money will not be satisfied with that silver or that money. And one who loves to have a lot of servants around, he will not have any grain. And this is also futility. So he's spending his energies on that which is not going to give him sustenance, so that's a foolish thing. The first and foremost activity that a person should be engaged in is addressing his primary needs. All right, do we have all the mute buttons on? Still getting a lot of static back here. All right. So what we said was that, number one, and this is Sforno, that the reason why a person will not be satisfied with the, and you see he uses the word yizba, which means satiation, typically used in connection with sustenance. So the person's going after money, he's not going to be satisfied with money. Why? Because the primary reason, and that is that the money is not the end objective, as the Sforno says. Because really what he needs is to get grain. He needs to have his needs taken care of, his food. So when a person is loving money, he's really, it's a displacement. So when he gets the money, it can't satisfy him because that's not the object that he really has in the back of his mind. All right. So let's go further. So now he goes into another issue. He says as follows, and this is now in 5:10 in Kohelis. When there's an increase in good, in wealth, so then also the consumers will increase. And what benefit is there, therefore, to the owners, other than just what he sees with his eyes? So what is he addressing here? When there's an increase of wealth, so then there'll be an increase in the consumers, meaning those who eat, who devour the wealth, will increase. And therefore, what benefit is there to the owners, other than what he sees with his eyes? Okay, so what? Yes, Doug, go ahead.
So is he suggesting that, okay, if you just keep working and working and working for more and more and more, that that old adage, you know, the budget manages to expand to meet the expenditures expand to meet the budget, that people will keep showing up to, you know, eat the goods or consume all that you've managed to produce. And so the only real advantage you get to working that much harder is just sort of a personal satisfaction when you see all those people with your, you know, eating of your food, all the people that kind of showed up out of the woodwork, and you may congratulate yourself internally, but there's, that's just kind of an illusionary psychological benefit.
Right. Is that a benefit, though?
Well, I guess a psychological illusion is not a real benefit unless you want to count the fact that somehow you get some brief psychological satisfaction out of that, but it has no real long-term benefit or result for you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, Sforno seems to say the same thing, that when he sees the multitudes that are convalescing, that they are enjoying, they're repairing themselves with the knees when they're being fed by his money. So there seems to be his pointing to something there, because he says, what benefit is there other than what he sees with his eyes, meaning when he sees the people that are, well, there's some good happening. But evidently, he's trying to say that's more peripheral, and that's not what the person really intended. So what is, you know, we have to take our regular approach. And that is, well, if he's telling us a point over here, we must have had an opposite or a different assumption. What was the assumption that we had that he is now correcting with this verse? Right? He says that when you increase your wealth, so also will the consumers increase. What is he telling you?
That much beyond your own practical need, it's a waste of time or a waste of effort to keep accumulating wealth beyond what you need.
Right. That the person is, it's really just going to, you're going to increase your wealth, but then, I mean, we also have to understand, why is it that the consumers increase? So Mitsuda's Dove says like this. He says, when a person has his increase in good in his life and his success increases, it's the way of the world that the masses come to eat from his good. And then there's only left to him maybe less than what he had to begin with. How ironic is that? So the guy is making $100,000 a year, then he starts making $1 million, but then out of the $1 million, he's left with maybe $25,000 because all the consumers increased, he had less at the end. Evidently, you know, the I don't know if there is an adage, but there should be one, that, you know, a wealthy man has more friends than a poor man. So that type of a concept that people are, they crowd around, they just want his money. And why does he part with it is a good question. He doesn't have to part with it just because people come. He made the money. Why does he hold on to it? It seemed to be that there's an underlying lesson we can gain, is that the person who has the wealth, so what good is it if he doesn't have people that will applaud it? Really underlying the wealth is really a status, a concept of the status that now I'm wealthy. And I don't know if this is in every case, but I can see it being in a very large amount of cases, that the spreading of the money and the sharing it, then you don't want to turn people away. You want to get the accolades. But the way they get the accolades is by making big, lavish feasts and things that will be very impressive. So, and the people will come, and then in his own mind, now he feels good. But now what's happening is he's increasing the amount of consumers, and he's left with less. So that's number one, like you're saying. And really, what benefit is there other than the fact that he had a certain momentary psychological satisfaction that he sees this? But that is quickly fades. But there's also another thing here. And that is that there's the he's trying to correct the attitude of a person. Now, this verse, what we just addressed so far, is in terms of what happens once he has it. Okay? So, once he has it, so that his friends, or people that come out of the woodwork, you know, everybody wants this, wants that. And he himself is allowing this to happen. Because, again, the psychological need of having that, the accolades of the masses. But let's go a step backwards. He's addressing a notion of a person that you think that he's really, again, we have to keep on reiterating this practice, but the more we do this, the more I think it'll train us in understanding how to, you know, learn new verses. So if he's saying that when you increase your wealth, so then really the consumers are going to increase, he's trying to address what you might have thought otherwise. You might have thought what? That by increasing the wealth, I will have more wealth. But his answer is no, you'll have less. So the assumption that he's addressing is that the increase in wealth is really something which remains. So I think the more primary lesson over here is that there's a certain illusion that there is a good with having that wealth. And of course, if a person uses wealth properly, he'll live a good life. And I mean, we know that the patriarchs and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses, they were all very wealthy people. And that even the Maimonides even says that a person cannot be a prophet unless he is independently wealthy. He has to have wealth, because evidently that sets the stage in his mind where all needs are taken care of, and he can direct his energies towards God all that more. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Does this verse also allude to human nature in the sense that when somebody comes into wealth or something, that other people feel maybe entitled to it or something in some way?
If it's a friend, I think that there's definitely going to be jealousy, that's for sure. If you really get down to it, entitled to it, it's a good question. Maybe the jealousy really is based on the fact that why should he have it, not me? So maybe you're right. Maybe the very underpinnings of jealousy is that a person's, you know, warped sense of justice, in some way he feels entitled, but it's not a correct thought. But I think you are correct, that the person does, the sense of entitlement is there. That's what is the underpinning of the jealousy. But the question is that a correct thing to have? And should I retain that, or should I remove it because it really is not right? He made the money. He worked. I mean, you see, you know, you have friends, and they work very hard, and they make a lot. So they're putting the effort. They deserve it. If a person chooses to have more of a simple life, he wants to put more energy into learning and so on, he's accepting that he's not looking for a lot of wealth. So he sees his friend make a lot. That's his. That should be the real understanding, and that he worked really hard. He deserves it. I have no claim on it. That's the proper attitude. The improper attitude is that sense of entitlement, you know, especially with a friend who I know, and he just came into so much, and so on and so forth. But, you know, people all have this fantasy. So, you know, King Solomon is going to slowly go through and show you different reasons why this fantasy of wealth is really doesn't translate into reality. And, for example, if we just jump to the next verse for a moment. So the next verse says that the sleep of the worker is very sweet, whether he eats a lot or eats a little. But the wealth, the satisfaction, which the rabbis say means the wealth of the rich man, does not allow him to sleep. So what happens, what he's saying over here, he's addressing in the next verse, is what is a person looking at in terms of, are you looking at an illusion or are you trying to live your life in reality? And that is really a primary theme throughout this whole book. And like Chaim Emunsi's writing, says that a successful man has no nachas, he has no pleasure unless he has somebody to share it with. Right, we mentioned that earlier. Right. That happens to be a real thing, but if we think about this, so the person's illusions is really what they're going after, and they're not living in reality. In reality, you see this verse, verse 11, what does King Solomon say? He says, the sleep of the common everyday worker is sweet. Whether he eats a lot or little, meaning whether he's got a lot of money, he's got little money, he can sleep at night. And he's trying to tell you that that's a real thing. Let's look at the reality, King Solomon says. You want to talk about money? You want to examine things objectively? Let's use reality as a barometer of what is a good value system. Now, let's take a look at one element of a person's day, which is very important to him. That's his sleep. His time where he's done with the work, and he needs to have a little relaxation. And it's necessary. And a person knows how important sleep is, and he wakes up refreshed in the morning. His whole sense of self is all dependent upon having that sleep. And he says, a person who's a worker, the regular worker, whether he has a lot or little, whether he eats a lot or little, he has a very sweet sleep. Why? Because you look at the last part of the verse. The wealthy man, the rich man, can't sleep at night because he's worried about his wealth. I have to ensure it. The more, and Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Father, says this as well. When you increase your possessions, you increase your anxiety. You're worried about protecting your investment. The more money you have, the more you're worried about who might take it from you or how am I keeping it, where is going to be the best increase in terms of inflation or percentage or growth, however it's going to work. So that's another angle, but he's using reality. Let's look at the person's experiences during the day as opposed to these fantasies. You think, in verse 10, I'm going to increase my wealth. So that's the illusion that the person has. So then King Solomon writes verse 10 in order to show you, well, what does reality say is going to happen if you increase your wealth? So he said, let's use reality as the barometer. Let's get into the habit of abandoning what our assumptions are, just because the rest of the world may be acting that way and thinking that way. Use reality as your barometer. Who's really sleeping well at night? The worker. He has nothing to worry about. He can close his eyes at night. He's got nothing to worry about. And the truth is also, if a person will look past the, like I was reading in Duties of the Heart, and he closes off his 10th chapter, the 10th gate. And he closes off by talking how a person really should consider that maybe today he'll die. Maybe that'll be it. Meaning to say that don't have a fantasy that you're living forever. Because it's because of that fantasy that you're living forever that can catapult a person into trying to amass such tremendous amounts of money and never really live his life, but he's working all the time, more and more and more. But he doesn't think about the fact that he's going to die. It's a denial of that. And because of that, that allows him to try to build things and amass more and make big structures in his name. But if he stopped and he realized that everybody dies, and he's going to die soon, he wouldn't have the energy to put into that. He'd start thinking about what is real, what could be an eternity of good for him in the afterlife. Okay, let me just stop here and see if there's any comments or questions. Let me see on screen. Naomi is writing, we never had sealed doors, as the thief knows there's nothing with us. Okay. Okay, and Avner, you're saying it's a bad discussion for a meeting with Jews. Elaborate. I assume you mean that sarcastically. Okay, let me just see if there's any questions or comments up to this point. Sure. You see two major rules that we got to come away with today. One is that he's addressing fantasies that people have. You have to think about what is King Solomon addressing over here in this verse. And number two, is that if we want to know what is real, what is true, use reality as a barometer. There are many, many basic lessons we could derive just by observing who's sleeping at night. Just a simple observation. Now, who's really having the pleasure on a day-to-day basis? And who's really having the anxiety? So far, he showed clearly that the person who's going after the wealth, he's following an illusion, so therefore an illusion can't translate into reality. So there's going to be a frustration there when what he wants really doesn't happen. He wants to amass a lot of money, and it ends up, because of that, everybody's knocking on his door, and he's got less this year than he had last year, even though he made 10 times as much. And he doesn't think about another thing, too. What about my simple pleasures, my ability just to sleep at night, to lie down, and to be able to fall asleep, and to really get the rest that I need, to feel good, just so I have that's like the substratum of a good day is the fact that the person had sleep the night before. Yes, you see how he's just following a very straight path. And it's funny, he even says in verse 11 that the sleep of the worker will be very sweet, whether he eats a lot or little. Meaning the real physical, even if he's hungry, the hunger itself is something which is out of proportion. People get worried about, all right, so today he didn't have so much to eat, but he can sleep, the more primary need. He can actually have a good night's sleep. Again, he can feel that's more important. And a person could have his belly full. The person could, like the end of the verse, he could be a very rich person, and he had the greatest meal. So fine. But if you can't sleep, what good does that meal do you? And Naomi, the body and the soul are at peace when a person has a good night's sleep. Okay, and Avner, you're writing, but the fact is, though money is an imperfect thing, it is a real means to reach significant and necessary goals. Look at Judah the prince, Yehuda Nasi. Right. No, we're not saying money is bad. We're saying that the person who's living on the fantasies of money is bad. But I mentioned to you that the patriarchs, Moses, they were all wealthy. And that a prophet has to be a wealthy person. So wealth is a good. It's the fantasies and the misguided path and the illusions that a person attaches to it. That's the negative. Nobody's saying that wealth is negative itself. Okay. All right, so I think that addresses 10, verse 10, right? And he ends up by saying that what good is all the wealth? The consumers will increase and you'll have less wealth than you did before. And all the owner really has is just the seeing of his eyes, some satisfaction, momentary that is. Okay, and Avner, you're writing that King Solomon's approach is imperfect, and anyway, because you're saying that many poor people can't sleep well today's days. Well, what he's talking over here is the sleep that's disrupted by anxiety, and that's what King Solomon is saying that the poor person doesn't have. Since he doesn't really have anything to be concerned with about, so he can sleep at night because there's nothing to do at night. I mean, nighttime is a period where people are not in the mode of accomplishing and building empires. That's the time when people sleep. So in that, third of the day, he is better off than the wealthy man. Because what the wealthy man takes to bed with him are all his anxieties, his worries. That is something which the poor man does not have. So in as much as he's lacking that, he may not have money, but right now there's no need, so therefore it doesn't disrupt the sleep. The money becomes an issue in terms of the basic necessity he has, and the truth is a person has a meal and he's eating on a daily basis and he has clothing, so then he'd be able to sleep better than the rich man. That's what he's talking about. And Tina, you're asking, but wouldn't a poor person be anxious for not being able to pay his bills? That's a good question. Wouldn't a poor man still have anxiety that he can't pay his bills? That's a good question. So why don't we say that although he doesn't have to worry about money and what he's going to do with it, why can't we say that he's worried about other things? Why doesn't that worry keep him up at night?
Rabbi, do you suppose there's an implication that a rich man is constantly wanting more, but the laborer accepts his situation in life and says, okay, I'm a laborer, this is what I make. And so he may be, he's more accepting of his own lot in life than the rich man.
And what about, so you're saying that the ability for him to sleep at night is not because he's worried about, it's not because of the, you know, concerned about the consumption of his goods. You're saying that it's more of a my lot, an overall view of the self.
Yeah, he doesn't, I'm gonna postulate here that he doesn't have the same aspirations as the rich guy. And maybe that's how he ends up having labor that is sweet. And then a completely different possibility would be that because he's a laborer, he physically works his body. While the rich man generally will have other people working for him and doing the heavy lifting, so to speak. And so, at the end of the day, when you work hard physically, the sleep that you get, I would say, is better than the sleep of the person who did, you know, a whole bunch of work in their head or a whole bunch of worrying in their head, but wasn't actually physically doing something.
So that would be good for the verse, because the verse says that the sleep of a laborer is sweet. So maybe laborer meaning that he's physically exerting himself.
Right.
Yeah, Rashi takes a line, he says that he's used to this, whether he eats a lot or a little. Since he's, I guess, used to that type of lifestyle, where he's eating a lot or a little, so that... he's accepted that. Let's see who else comments on this. Because the verse itself is saying that the wealth of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. That means that he is preoccupied with his money. That is something which the laborer doesn't have. So that alone allows the person to have that sleep. That alone allows the person to have the sleep. There are other things that cause anxiety too, but we'd have to think into, is that going to affect the person sleep-wise? Or can he sleep, but then when he deals with his bills the next day, that's really something he could relegate to his daytime. But then we have to explain the phenomenon. Why is there a difference? The person who's got wealth, we just talked this out, the person who's got lots of wealth, so he's worried about losing it. So that's on his mind as he goes to sleep at night. As opposed to a person that doesn't have the means and he's got to pay a bill, so it's a different type of an anxiety. Okay, let me also bring some more things from on screen, people writing. All men are not of equal abilities. Maybe successful men do things that unsuccessful men do not want to do. A higher intelligent businessman is able to be more successful because they have a higher mental quality. All right. That's true. I'm not sure how that plays in over here. Gabrielle, you're writing, it seems that what is at issue seems not wealth per se, but the idolatrous aspect of it. Whether we have ourselves dominated by wealth or anxiety isn't both a form of idolatry. Well, it's not idolatry in the sense of the Jewish term idolatry. But the question is what the different type of anxieties are, and do they have, it is an interesting question, whether different anxieties have a role in terms of a person's sleep, or do they only present themselves at certain moments. But in terms of the person sleeping at night, so he's got a bed to sleep on right now, so it could be that mental state of the pauper, he just lives in, bite-sized pieces. He's got something right now, that's it. He's focused on the reality of that he's got a bed to sleep in right now, and he can compartmentalize that moment, and he can sleep. The next day comes, he's got to pay a bill. Maybe that's how he works. Maybe that's why it's not going to disrupt his sleep. Whereas a person who has in his possession money, so that's something which is the fear of loss is more disturbing. I can't really pinpoint why that is, but I'm just I'm trying to describe maybe what the differences might be. Yeah, that was to answer Tina before.
I noticed that the verse makes a distinction, though. It's talking about a laborer, not a poor person, and I wonder if that's the difference.
Yeah, that's also a good point. Meaning the laborer still has something. He is working. Maybe, and so that would be a good point that, but a poor person who's got nothing, then maybe he would have anxiety at night. That's a good point there, Cal. You see the rule, though. The rule is that what you assume and what you fantasize about has to be tested against reality. And Naomi is writing, will tzedakah help to achieve the balance a rich person to enjoy both life? Well, certainly the Torah guarantees a person that. That's the one area you're allowed to test God. It says in Malachi, in the book of Malachi. So there in chapter 3, he talks and he says that that's one case where God says, test me, please, in this. See if I don't open up the storehouses of heaven and give you a blessing more than enough. And that's talking about testing God only one area, and that is to give your truma, your tithe, your charity. So there you're allowed to test God. And there the response is that, don't worry, you're not going to be harmed through it. It'll actually be a source of security for you. Okay. All right, any other comments or questions?
None here.
Okay, so maybe we'll wrap it up here and continue with verse. We did the 11 also today. So we'll pick up with, maybe we'll just rehash 11 and go on to 11 and 12 next week, all right? All right, so I wish everybody a good week, and you can look over the next verse. So So we'll be prepared for next week, and we'll pick up the same time.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Thank you.